The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. This week, we have got part two of what's going to be a series of unknown length at this point. It shouldn't be as long as the series we did a couple of years ago on our full retirement planning process, the why and the how we do our retirement planning. This series, which we started last week, if you will, is talking about how we approach asset management. And we're not going to rehash the entire first episode, thankfully. But in that episode, mostly Jim started telling a story of kind of how the history of asset management at the firm progressed. And as if you listen to the last show, you know at the very end there, we kind of got the story up to about 2009, where Jim had discovered that a lot of the portfolios that were actively managed by professionals turned out to not perform well through that financial crisis, as well as they were, marketed to hopefully perform. And as one would expect, based on what they were trying to do, the strategies these active managers were trying to deploy. So we're going to turn back to Jim now, and he's going to pick up where he left off and tell us kind of how did he evaluate what had happened at that point and then search for a better way, at least in our opinion, of approaching things, particularly for retiree portfolios specifically.
Okay, well, welcome everybody to another EDU show, and thanks for the intro, Chris. Hopefully everybody can remember. If you haven't, or if you're new and just listening to this, I would suggest listening to part one before just jumping into part two, obviously. But we kind of left off, Chris, I think it was just about 2009. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do again on this series is walk you through the rationale behind why we do what we do. That to me is very important. If you're going to hire anybody, especially in the financial services industry, you really need to know why they believe in what they do and why they do it the way they do. Because I would say, Chris, in our industry, we often say it's a art based on science. There's a few certain facts that we know we have to abide by. Required minimum distributions begin at 72, things like that. But for the most part, there's no set in stone correct way to project retirement, and there's no set in stone correct way to manage assets. Mm-hmm. Would you agree on those?
Yeah, I think there's many paths to, quote, success, if you will. There's also many paths to failure. And I think when you're looking at an approach that you're going to use for yourself, whether you're a do-it-yourself or deploying it yourself, or you're engaging with a professional who's going to help you do it, the most important thing, I think, above all else, or something that kind of transcends the approach, is belief in the approach, understanding why this approach is being taken and having that resonate with you. It makes sense to you and you're buying into it because it just, it's more comfortable that way. You'll be more apt to deploy it and work through it the way it was designed if you've bought into it, etc. So it all kind of starts with something that most folks don't talk about, the why. It's, you know, they talk about the how. This is how we do it. This is what we do. This is what we're going to do for you, etc. But they leave off the whole backstory why, mostly because, in my opinion, they don't have a good answer for it. They haven't really thought of it that way. They just do it this way because that's what they were told to do. And doesn't mean what they were told to do is necessarily wrong, but I think one should always ask the question, why? And hopefully you'll get a great answer. You know, this is why, and that makes perfect sense. So yeah, that's why we told you to do it this way is we believe this. Oh, that makes sense, and I'm buying into it. So I think that part is very important and not focused on enough.
I agree. Okay, so that's what we hope to do, excuse me, on today's show again, folks, is get a little bit more into the why. And if you remember, we left off, it was in 2009, the 2008 crash had ended. It was later in 2009, keep that in mind, the market recovery didn't happen until I believe it was February or March of 2009. And at first, Chris, if you remember, a lot of people thought it was a head fake, dead cat bounce, whatever you want to call it. The markets were going to keep going down, they were going to keep going down. And there was a lot of people, professional investors, financial planners, or investment advisors like our firm, individual investors, who took a long time to get back into the market. Sadly, some people didn't get back in for years. Do you agree there?
Yeah, it turned out in hindsight that was sad. Obviously, if it kept going down, they would have been thought of as geniuses. but at this point, now that we know what happened, getting back in the market or staying in through the whole period, you know, admitting, I think, what most people should admit, that in hindsight, the best option would have been to bail out before it went down and then jump back in. But oh my gosh, the only way to do that is with the 2020 of hindsight. But sticking through it or getting back in relatively quickly is what ended up benefiting people financially the most. Because after it, you know, after it dipped down and hit bottom in about December of 2008, kind of lingered around there for a while and then started trudging back up, not as aggressively as it went down. Took quite a while to come back fully. But yeah, I think staying out for years in hindsight turned out to hurt a lot of people.
Exactly. And sadly, we have met people who did stay out of the market for a very long time. It's one reason myself and many advisors don't believe in market timing. Mm-hmm. There's a saying out there in our industry, Chris. It goes something to the effect of it's time in, I-N. It's time mm-hmm. in the market, not timing, I-N-G, the market. Yep. It's time in, not timing. So before I go any further, though, because I do know a lot of advisors, especially younger advisors, listen to Chris and I. We are not saying at all our approach to retirement planning or our approach to investment management is the only way it should be done. We're not saying that at all. It's the way we do it, and we believe in it. We feel comfortable with it. We feel it's reasonable. We feel it's understandable. It's definable. It's defendable. It's understandable. I think I said that one already. But it doesn't mean everyone has to do it. It doesn't mean if you do things differently, if you continue to use active management in your portfolios, which we made the decision not to use, although I will say maybe about 10-12% of some of the assets we have are actively managed, but the vast majority, I'd say 88 or more percent of our assets is passively managed. We just made that decision, or more me than Chris. Chris mm-hmm. does the planning. He leaves the investment and the decisions on the investment side to me. I made that decision to go passive. We don't want anyone listening to this who does active to think we're picking on them or going after them. We certainly aren't. And if it sounds that way, I want to apologize now ahead of time. It's not what I'm doing. I have a lot of colleagues in this field. I've been doing it for 23 years. Most of them are active managers. It's one of the ways that they defend their fee, if you will, or add credence to their fee. I just chose not to go that route anymore. And they respect my choice and I respect their choice. Mm-hmm. And it's not an argument and it's not picking on them. there is no correct approach. And I think people are going to be arguing this till the cows come home.
Forever.
Yeah. It's just one of the arguments in our industry, active-passive, passive-active, up-down, east-west.
Well, I will, out of full disclosure, and I'm sure in conversations we had prior to your transition, I have, for longer than you have, been in the passive camp. So you didn't have to do much convincing of me to switch over to this approach, because I favor the passive approach. Again, not saying that you're doomed with the active approach by any means. I just prefer the lower cost simplicity of a passive approach. My preference.
Okay. So let's start where I left off. It was early 2009, and I was comparing our portfolios to that of the quote-unquote market or a benchmark. Now, back then, folks, I did not have a benchmarking software like we have access to today. Going back, I know 09 is not that long ago, but back then my software was a lot weaker than it is today, and I'm sure 10 years from now we're going to look back, Chris, at what we use today and think, oh my God,
right.
How did we do it back then in 2022? But back then I didn't have access to a lot of the active benchmarking software. I had software, though, that I could enter in a portfolio and then, I guess, after the fact, show what it did. It worked wonderful, this software, as long as I didn't have to program cash flows. If I had to get into programming cash flows, and I don't want to get too deep into this, a CFA, if they're listening, they're probably going, oh yeah, God, cash flows would mess everything up. Cash flows make it a lot more difficult when you're programming it by hand. So I started evaluating portfolios, Chris, where there were no cash flows, mm-hmm. positive or negative. Money coming in, money coming out. It was buy and hold portfolios I started objectively looking at because I could program them in. And then I had to choose a benchmark. We talk about benchmarking a lot now because so many advisors don't benchmark portfolios. But if I was going to evaluate, I looked at portfolios, and to me, they did not perform the way I had hoped they would have performed. But then I had to go out and prove that, either prove my assumption was wrong or prove that it was correct. So what I had to do then, Chris, is figure out, well, what am I going to compare it to? I can't compare an apple to an orange. I can't look at, say, a 60-40 moderate portfolio and compare it to the S&P 500. That's stupidity. Nor should I compare it to a intermediate bond. That, too, would be stupidity. So I had to find something to benchmark it to. We use Morningstar portfolios right now, but they came out in 07, and in 09, they didn't have much track record, mm-hmm. if you would. Mm-hmm. So what I had to do is create composite portfolios and try to use indexes or an index fund. I always felt more comfortable comparing the portfolio, at least back then, not to an index that I cannot invest directly in, Chris, but I wanted to compare it to something that I could have invested directly in if I chose to.
Mm-hmm.
So I created my own composite benchmarks, if you will, using actual investments that I had access to or could have had access to had I chose to do that. Does that make sense, kind of what I was doing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So also keep in mind, folks, you might, especially you do-it-yourselfers who would probably come home from your engineering job and then sit behind your computer for 8 hours loving to do this. I was trying to run a business back then. And in 2008, 2009, 2010, the period of time that Chris and I are referencing, it was me, it was a full-time admin, and it was a part-time Chris. That's all we had back then, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And I did it all. I'm not wearing that as a badge on my chest, but I literally was doing everything. Chris didn't meet with clients at that time. He did a lot of the programming behind the scene, and he also helped me when I would bounce ideas off of him. So I didn't have, it wasn't that I could sit there, Chris, every day for 8 hours looking at this. So it took a long time for me to start doing. And I didn't feel rushed, folks, because the markets were still very choppy. Even though they were recovering, the economy was still choppy, the markets were choppy. And there's one thing no one should ever, ever do, is make an emotional decision. And I wasn't going to make a massive change to my investment philosophy because of one period of time I was fixating on a real estate bubble burst in 08 and a market correction. I wasn't going to use that and just make a rash, irrational decision. So I wanted to chill and think things through. And that's what I did. So I started designing my own composite benchmarks, if you will. And then I would randomly choose client portfolios and put them in and compare them to this composite benchmark. But I also wanted to give, if you will, Chris, active management a shot. I wanted to give it a chance. So there's a type of fund out there called an allocation fund. They generally come in three flavors like Neapolitan ice cream, strawberry, chocolate, vanilla. Mm-hmm. These come in conservative, moderate, and aggressive. I don't want to name the funds because Chris and I don't do that on the show. We just refrain from that. Even though I'm not a broker anymore, Chris, and regulated under FINRA, and if we ever mentioned a fund back then, oh my God, all the disclosures we would have to read. Even though we don't have to worry about that necessarily anymore because I'm not a broker and I'm not under the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, I have chosen not to really name funds. But what I did do is there's a lot of very good, in my opinion, moderate allocation funds. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of our clients, and I think it's because we work exclusively with retirees or pre-retirees, Chris, have what portfolio?
Most, if I had to pick, you know, the most frequently I see would be moderate.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Sure. So I started researching allocation funds as well. And I wanted to find, in my opinion, allocation funds that met my criteria of what a good allocation fund should be. And I'm trying to go from memory now on some of the things I was looking for, but I wanted it a 15-year or longer track record. I wanted a group manager. You know why I chose group managers and not individual?
I know exactly why, even though we haven't talked about this. It's if you have a superstar manager, you're running the risk that they're going to leave, and then the fund doesn't perform anything like it did before. So going with a team, you've got a lot more stability there, and it's group input, et cetera. You get the benefits of that while they're there. And then as there's transitions in and out, things still stay pretty stable and consistent.
Exactly. I, long ago, because I was burned, learned to avoid the superstar managers.
Right.
They may have their time in the sun or spotlight, whatever that saying is. And sometimes they could have that time in the spotlight for a year or two, sometimes for a decade. But let me tell you, folks, when they fall, and very rarely do they come flying back. So I long ago, regrettably, learned there were two particular managers, and again, I won't mention them, that let me down, if you will. And it was after the second one that I says, no more. I'm not doing the superstar manager anymore. I could give a damn on that. I want a group. Plus, I always wanted as a firm, as a retirement planning firm, we have Chris and I treat investment management and retirement planning separately. Financial planners do planning. Investment advisors do investing. We always separate those out. And again, at our firm, we'll chat about him on a future show, we hired a chartered financial analyst, which is an investment manager, an investment advisor. That's all they do, CFAs. We hired one to run that part of our practice, or at least help me run that part of the practice. We specifically keep them separate, if you will. So that's important to also keep in mind. So as I was looking through the portfolios and coming up with what I thought, in my opinion, were very good moderate allocation funds, I started then comparing and looking at the portfolios I had to the composite benchmark, which were comprised of funds that I could actually have gone out and purchased. None of them were indexed. I still had all active funds, but I started comprising a composite benchmark of active funds, low-cost funds, quote-unquote low-cost, the true low-cost comes in when you go to passive. And then these actively managed allocation funds to see what someone or groups of someone, Chris, are doing all the time, when they do that all the time. The ugly little truth in our industry, folks, is that even when we manage assets for our clients, even when we manage assets for our clients, we're not constantly watching the stock market. We're not sitting there throughout the day saying, what's the market doing? What's the bond market doing? What's large caps doing? Small caps? What about foreign markets? How's emerging markets? We don't do that. Now, again, as I said, we've hired an outsourced chartered financial analyst. I would imagine, I never asked him, but I would imagine he looks at it far more throughout the day than we do.
Oh, I'm sure he does. That's built into their DNA, right? That they're going to be paying attention to what's going on every day, watching the news and seeing how that's affecting the markets, et cetera, because that's going to form their opinion about how worried they need to be about certain things that would affect their management style.
But most, when you're working with an advisor, especially if they're still growing their practice and actively looking for clients, they spend a lot of their time looking for clients, marketing, taking care of administrative tasks, meeting with clients, and they're not necessarily just sitting there looking at the market. So do keep that in mind, folks. So all of this started bringing me through 2009 and then into 2010. And as I started getting into 2010 and the markets are recovering and I'm starting to look at everything, I started thinking back, and I may have shared with you because you were with me at the time. And do you remember, I think briefly I did this. It was less than a year, but I came up with the theory of doing the core satellite strategy. Does that ring a bell with you?
Yeah.
So what I have to go back to my Boston University days when I was studying financial planning, folks, which again was in the mid-90s, in the middle of the massive bull market. Core Satellite was an investing strategy they taught us during the investment class. Now, you'll laugh at this, but to them back then, you would have a core like a planet, this big core, and then around it all these little satellites. The core, you know what they told us to use as a core in the mid-90s? The base of all our client portfolios. You have any idea what they told us to use?
My guess is just a nearly 100% equity portfolio is the core.
100% equity, yep. Mimicking the S&P 500. Yep. Never told us to go out and buy an index S&P 500 fund, a growth stock fund. That's what we would want. And that was to be 50 or more percent of a client portfolio was going to be this. And then they went on to explain to us that a lot of, especially on the S&P, it's large cap U.S. growth. So you would add satellites of smaller holdings. So you might have another fund with less money in it, obviously, folks, with foreign stocks and then maybe small cap stocks because they're not adequately represented in the S&P, and maybe mid-caps in a technology or micro-caps. And they never were telling us to put fixed income. I always remember that. It was always stocks. But back then, folks, they thought owning all those different types of stocks would insulate you if large-cap stocks fell. I think what ruined that theory, and it might have worked in the 30s and 40s, I don't know, or 50s, I think globalization kind of ruined that when a sneeze in America could cause a subsequent sneeze in France. The economies are just too intertwined now. Something happening in one country can set a market catastrophe in others. So what we were taught in the 90s doesn't really hold true, but that's how they taught us, folks. I just remembered that core satellite strategy. So I thought this, folks, why don't I start modeling? And again, I'm still thinking only active. Why don't we take the allocation funds that I had researched, which are actively managed, moderate allocation, 60-40 generally is what those funds were mandated to hold. Some could go higher in equity, some lower if you read the prospectus. But I found what I thought were a good group of about five actively managed allocation funds. And I thought this, Chris, I'm going to use those as a core. And then as the satellite, I'm going to start adding areas of the market or sectors of the market that are poised to outperform. That's what I thought. I didn't keep this for long, folks, so don't worry. But that was the initial idea going through my head. And it's also when I hired a CFA to start doing the research. So we brought on a chartered financial analyst. I interviewed several and hired one out of Georgia. And I explained to him what I was going to do. And I told him I need him to evaluate that concept. I need him to compare it to benchmarks. And I need to start seeing how this approach may work. And I also wanted him not to write an algorithm, but I wanted him, Chris, to write a series of rules that if CPI, I'm just making this up, folks, but it was something like if CPI was above a certain level and the producer price stayed below this level, we were going to load up on industrial equities. And if this, all these silly little ideas that I had gathered throughout the years or were reading in other investment periodicals at the time. And I thought to myself, if we can come up with some good rules and follow the rules, that was going to be it, Chris, discipline, mm-hmm. I had a feeling that approach was going to do well. And at the time, I was still fixated on quote-unquote beating this benchmark. Because an active manager, that's what's drilled into their heads. You certainly don't want to do less than the benchmark. If you were only going to equal the benchmark, why not buy the benchmark? So they have to do better. You follow me there, Chris?
Yes.
So I thought that was going to be our best approach. And I hired the CFA, and this was somewhere in 2010. We might have been getting into 2011. And he was polite. He didn't quite like the idea of trying to come up with these measures, these rules, if you will. But he was going to try and share. He wanted to research first the allocation funds and then the satellites. What satellites would we use in different sectors and when we were going to use them, so to speak. So that was my core satellite approach. And I don't want to get too deep into it because I'll bore the hell out of everyone. But I think it was not more than 6 months or so into the CFA. He just pretty much sat me down. We talked over the phone, and he killed that whole idea, Chris. Mm-hmm. He just absolutely said it would be asinine to try to do. That's not the approach we should take. It wasn't going to work. And he said, do you have any other ideas? And I says, well, you know, we have to keep in mind something. I got to make sure we can figure out what went wrong. Is it active management itself? Or was it the funds I was using? Mm-hmm. Were the funds bad in 08-09? Or was active management what let us down? And I said, the other thing I need to figure out, what is the best approach for working with retirees? But I also explained to him, and this was also something that's important to me, it's not just retirees now, while they still have their mental faculties, if you will. They still have their abilities to understand and do things. We have to find the best portfolios for people as they get into their late 70s, 80s, maybe even 90s. And also keep in mind one more thing. Chris, back then, were we big with do-it-yourselfers?
No, actually, at that time.
Not at all, folks. So we were dealing with investors who didn't know a mutual fund right. from an exchange-traded fund.
Not sophisticated investors that have any experience doing it on their own.
Right. Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I used to despise working with do-it-yourselfers because they all thought they knew it all. Now, I love working with do-it-yourselfers.
We've seen the light.
Oh, my Lord. Y'all know what's going on. Exactly. I can talk to you and you get it. Yeah. I love it. But back then, I'm serious, folks. Back then, the vast, vast majority of our clients knew nothing about this. So we also had to keep it simple. And I had to design something that would allow people, allow me as a manager and clients, if you will, as they age, to still understand what we're doing, or more importantly, be able to explain it to a spouse who may never have been as actively involved in the meetings, or a child, or a beneficiary, or another family member, or an agent under a POA. If they're stepping in to help a client, while they may have been cognitively unable to take care of themselves or their portfolio anymore. So there's a big, when you're dealing with just retirees, this is what you have to be thinking of. If you do it yourself, and if you're a financial planner listening to this, your clients aren't going to stay 65 and spot on with their portfolios forever. So this is everything I threw at our CFA's name is Travis. So everything that I threw at Travis. And then I let him start working his magic and doing his research. That's what those folks do. And then I went to a retirement planning meeting. You've heard this story before, Chris, in Boulder. Do you remember what happened when I was there?
Isn't that the meeting where you had the gall to bring up benchmarking and realized that nobody was doing it, and one took you aside and admitted why they didn't do it? Was it that meeting, or was there something else going on there?
You're very close. You're mixing that meeting with others, okay. But this is the place where... So let me back up. Chris will remember the story when he mm-hmm. hears it. So by now, we're looking at somewhere in 2011, maybe early 2012, but somewhere around there. I don't have the exact dates etched in my head. But I went to a retirement planning seminar down in Denver. I can't even remember who sponsored it. The only reason I went, it was in Denver.
Mm-hmm. And close.
We do retirement planning. And it was a day-long event. And I remember my girlfriend at the time drove me down to Denver. And she jumped on 36 and went up to Boulder. And I stayed in Denver. And then she was going to finish working in Boulder, drive down 36, pick me up, and we were going to head back. Mm-hmm. But when I was at the event, obviously there was a ton of Colorado people there because it was based in Colorado. And I met this one advisor from Boulder, just happened to be where the woman I was dating at the time worked. And we didn't talk about any investing or anything like that. But as the symposium winded down, he offered to give me a ride to Boulder rather than having her drive down. It would make no sense, he said. So I got a hold of her. I told her, hey, I'll meet you up in Boulder. I jumped in his car. We're driving. Mm-hmm. And he started asking me a little bit about my business and what you do. And I started relaying to him everything that I've been sharing with our listeners now. And I said, what I'm starting to do and what I'm starting to look at is a core satellite approach. And I said, I already have the satellites. And I explained how I hired a gentleman and he's looking at everything. And this is before Travis fully killed it. And he said to me, as we were driving, he says, do you mind if I ask you what are the core funds that you chose to use? What are the allocation funds that you chose to use as your core?
I remember this now.
Okay. And I shared to him the names. Mm-hmm. And when I said one name, and I will not mention this fund, when I said one name to him, mm-hmm. let's just call it the XYZ fund. He's driving. I'm sitting in the passenger seat. And he said, I'll never forget this. He says, don't talk to me or don't mention the XYZ fund. I hate that fund. And he's still driving on 36. He just shuts up. And I'm sitting there thinking that, you know, he's going to tell me why. And he didn't. So I asked him, do you mind telling me why you hate it? I said, I researched it. I found it. It met all my criteria. I listed the criteria I wanted. And he told me, folks, he said, I self-benchmark my portfolios to that fund. And I can never beat it. And then he went on to say, if my clients knew that, they would probably question, mm-hmm. why are they using me, or why are they working with me, or why are they paying me? I can't exactly remember how he worded it.
Yeah, so behind closed doors, he was comparing himself to this fund, realizing he could never beat it, but then not divulging that to anyone because he didn't want to have to explain or justify himself. But I totally remember that story now that you relay it like that.
And it was at that moment, folks, I realized I'm on to something. I think I'm getting this set. I think I know what I'm going to be doing. It's evolved since then, but I felt comfortable. I felt comfortable with the approach of trying to use allocation, try to set an allocation. The particular fund that I'm talking about had one of the more rigid allocations that they had to maintain. They didn't have a lot of leeway. Some of these allocation funds, if you read their prospectuses, have a huge amount of leeway. And it just kind of resonated with me. But as Chris also said, it resonated me in the sense, I don't know why he's not benchmarking. By then, by 2011, 2012, I got access to benchmarking software. I didn't have it in 08. I got access to it in either 11 or 12. And we started benchmarking our portfolios. I felt it's the only thing we can do. Benchmarking is a way to allow your client to compare what you are doing to a model benchmark. We benchmark now, and we always benchmark based on target risk. And we'll explain that in like the third show or fourth show when we explain what we do. But it also got me my eyes open, Chris, to benchmarking. Sadly, that gentleman, if you've heard the story in the past, we hung out a few more times. We got together a few more times. He never liked talking shop. He did not want to talk about work, didn't want to talk about his business. It was like pulling teeth from a baby trying to get him to open up and tell me about his business and what he does and how he does it. And I didn't read anything into that, but sadly, it came to my attention about a year or so after we met. We stopped eventually hanging out, but he did commit suicide. So I don't know if he had other issues going on. I assume he did. And it's sad. It ended sad, but it did open my eyes up a lot at that point in time. As all this was happening, Travis is doing his work, and he came back. He did not like the core satellite approach at all. I had been sharing with him my thoughts of passive investing. He did not like that at first. He didn't care for passive investing, but he was very receptive to what I want. He was working for me. And he started modeling passive portfolios. And what we thought we would do was, why don't we take some models and show 50% allocation funds. He did like, and to this day, I still like the allocation funds. And if you use allocation funds and you Vanguardians, Vanguard has two that are really good. You probably could shout out the answers of what two funds Vanguard has in that realm right now. So I have nothing against allocation funds. So what I started to say to Travis is, I said, look, not only do we need to find out what went wrong, and in case anyone's wondering what went wrong, if you will, you probably understand by now, it wasn't the funds. Travis went back and looked at all the funds that I was using. There was one, he was perfectly blunt with me, he did not like. But out of those others, they all scored, in Travis's opinion, as adequate funds. Some scored much, much higher than others, but he didn't necessarily feel it was any particular fund that was causing it. He had to admit the obvious. It was the active management wasn't working, and the fees of the funds were also pulling the negative performance down. Okay. But the other aspect, what is the best way to manage money, in our opinion, for retirees and keep things simple? And one of the things that I wanted was tax efficiency and easy to rebalance. And that kept bringing me back to exchange-traded funds and a model where we can buy and hold a certain model, use low-cost exchange-traded funds, passively managed. So between the passive managed and the ETF platform, get good tax efficiency. And I always thought, Chris, by that time, if we ever had, we believe in positioning, back then we called it bucketing, but we knew there could be emergencies where a client would call and need access to assets, and we have to go in and free them up. It's a pain in an active management approach because then you have to go and figure out, okay, well, which of these sectors are going to outperform? Which do we think are going to underperform? So we should overweight those and underweight these and try to free up the money that way. And it can get very complicated. Whereas if you manage money passively in a model, I can easily free up money on what is called a rebalance. You tell the software, here's our parameters. This is our model. This is what we want in each of these ETFs, which match a particular sector of the market or asset class. Rebalance, but when you're done, free up $50,000. So we want $50,000 in cash and a complete rebalance. So the software does that all itself. It sells, it rebalances, it frees the cash up, and it doesn't require massive moves. It's almost like trimming your hair, not cutting sections of it off. Not sure if I explained that right. Does it make sense
well.
To you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So that's what we wanted. So what Travis did is he said, okay, let's figure 50% active and 50% not satellite, 50% passive. Let's start offering a 50-50 portfolio. And that became our norm for a while.
Mm-hmm. With the thought that the quote benefits that could be gotten from the active managed funds, you're still gaining some of that, but you get some of that efficiency and low cost going on the passive half. So it's almost, you know, kind of a blend, kind of a best of both worlds kind of an approach. And at the time when you described it to me, you know, it sounded like a reasonable approach for what we were doing at the time.
Exactly. And that's what we thought. 50-50. So we're going to take the King Solomon approach. Mm-hmm. We're not going to jump all in passive. We're not going to jump all in active. So we monitored and we do our due diligence on our allocation funds. It worked perfectly for a moderate, moderately aggressive, or aggressive portfolio because Travis could manipulate the 50% in the passive to adjust for the allocation holdings, which were predominantly moderate. We found no actively managed aggressive allocation fund that we liked. There might be some out there now, but back then there was none we liked. None. Even Travis was like, there's none. We found a couple, too, as a matter of fact, on the conservative side, conservative allocation funds that we liked. So we had enough to create a conservative, moderate, and moderately aggressive portfolio within that realm. And as we figured, if anybody wanted an aggressive portfolio, you're 90% equities anyways. So we would use a lot of equity-based portfolios for those. So that's how we started. And I would say we did that approach for about a year, maybe a little bit more than a year. And I kept thinking, though, in the back of my mind, folks, I still like the idea of having portfolios geared more towards a established amount of risk. Because that was the one thing we were running into, Chris. We were looking at the performance. But as we started to look at the correlation or the beta or the standard deviation, even the Sharpe ratio, we were starting to realize the active portfolios were messing with it. Sometimes they were taking on, relative to those measures, more risk than we wanted. And to me, it's important if a client says they want a moderate amount of risk, you want to make sure you're delivering a moderate amount of risk. So by then, we had jumped knee deep into the Morningstar Target Risk Benchmarks, which were the benchmarks that came up in 07. I believe it was 2007. They came out in 07, and they were designed to allow advisors to be able to benchmark based on a targeted amount of risk. And that's why they're called the Target Risk Benchmarks. And we were finding the active funds were messing with that because they're not held to that constraint, Chris.
Right. They would swing back and forth in their level of risk. So, it can, you know, when we're trying to maintain a certain amount, they were behind the scenes doing what they do, but it would alter this for, you know, the people we had in these portfolios.
So I tasked Travis with another thing. I said, let's do this because we're doing this 50-50 and we kind of augment on the passive side to match the actively managed moderate and create what we feel are portfolios that track the benchmark. Why don't we just track the benchmark? And that's when I started thinking of that. So I tasked him with, I want you to create models for us and let's analyze and look at the following. Put 5% in an allocation fund, 95% in a 95% in an all passive. So let's just key on the moderate. So we would have a moderate allocation fund, put 5% in that, put 95% in a passive portfolio designed to mimic the Morningstar benchmark. And I'll explain on next week's show how we did that. And then I had him do 10-90, 15-85, 20-80, all the way through, folks, to 100% passive. Now, I paid him for this. He'll do what I say. It cost time and money to do this.
So he took this and he essentially back-tested. So looking at how the markets performed, if you were invested in these different ways that the Jim is describing, this mix of active and passive, from a very tiny bit of passive to all passive and everything in between. That's what he's describing. And Travis did the analysis to see how things would have performed had you taken that approach in the past.
Exactly.
And he got back to Jim with the results.
And he got back to me. And I wanted to know a simple thing. Is there alpha? And is it worth the added cost of the active? Is there enough alpha to justify the active management cost? And is the chance of this happening consistently, in his opinion, there? And he went through and he looked at it all, and it took him a long time to do all that. And when he started going over it with me, folks, the long and the short of it was, he even admitted, go 100% passive. For what I was trying to do, the active allocation funds, which again are from very reputable Wall Street, I don't want to say Wall Street, that they're all in New York on Wall Street, but Wall Street firms, they're throughout the country. Some of them are very minor firms. One of them's in the Midwest, I think in Minnesota or Michigan. But looking at all of those, he felt going 100% passive would be our best bet. And he had to admit that. And that's what we ended up doing. And I adopted that in, it was either late 18, early 19. We started using that exclusively. And we adopted an all ETF in 2020. And we've been doing that ever since. And I have absolutely no qualms about it. I think we did our research. I think we took our time. We evaluated. We tried to be objective. I'm a firm believer now, long after Chris, but a firm believer in passive. I get it, folks. It's not for everyone, and that is key. If you are a younger investor listening to this or a younger advisor, you probably don't want to do passive. I think someone younger, you may be able to benefit from more aggressiveness, or at least with a portion, If you wanted to overweight a healthcare sector or a technology sector, or if you wanted an energy focus or a more ESG focus, or if you wanted to try your luck at picking some individual equities, you can take that level of risk. You don't necessarily have to be a buy and hold 100% passive. I'll concede that. I did not back test my strategy for accumulation planning. I only back tested it and viewed it from a decumulation approach. And I wanted an approach that I could tell an 80 or an 85 year old and feel they understand what I'm saying. We're going to rebalance your portfolio, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Show them maybe what we're going to do. And as we rebalance, we'll free the cash up. We're not trying to time anything. And to also be able to show someone, if you want a moderate amount of risk or a conservative amount of risk or an aggressive amount of risk, I am delivering what you want because here is a benchmark, an impartial benchmark from a third-party firm that I have no control over. Here is our portfolio. Here is theirs. This is our correlation to the benchmark. This is your beta or risk relative to the benchmark. This is your standard deviation or volatility relative to the benchmark. This is our alpha relative to the benchmark. We don't have any. We're passive. We can't have alpha. What am I adding? I'm mimicking. So we can show people. There's another way I can prove to you I'm delivering you a benchmark. Look at our alpha. That's what I wanted to be able to show people. And that's what I believe in. But I didn't sit there, Chris, nor did I analyze. Well, if you're 25 and you don't need your money for 55 years, could you benefit from a greater volatility, higher risk, but potentially greater return active manager? I didn't evaluate that. And it very well could be true. So don't just take because I'm saying this and say, oh, that's what I'm going to do. Or don't bash me. Don't put negative reviews on our iTunes pod thing and saying, oh, Jim doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. He's this passive idiot, blah, blah, blah. We work with distribution clients. If you're in another advisor or if you're a younger listener, we work with people in the distribution phase. Low cost, buy and hold.
Easy to rebalance.
Easy to rebalance, easy to understand, easy to explain to a spouse or child or agent under a POA who doesn't know this, what's going on. That's what I was looking for. So this isn't a one-size-fits-all, and there could very well be a reason why someone younger, 40s, 30s, 20s, teens, would want a more active manager, Chris, would be willing to pay for someone who's going to actively manage and look for outperformers. But if you are doing that approach, ask for benchmarking still. Benchmarking is just not for older folk. If someone is managing a portfolio, especially if they're doing it actively, ask them to benchmark it and show you they are delivering something for the price you are paying. And Chris, I know that's a thorn in your side too. Why are we so adamant on benchmarking?
Well, because using the vague words of description and having the annual meetings without the benchmarking, you might feel good about what they say. What they're saying isn't necessarily wrong. It's just that it doesn't give a clear
picture,
objective picture of what's going on. It's subjective, and they generally use flowery adjectives and things like that. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're doomed because you didn't get the objective benchmarking story. It can be difficult to benchmark and hard to understand, and people have oftentimes an unrealistic expectation of what their asset manager is going to do for them. I blame mostly the asset managers for setting too high of an expectation themselves in describing how gloriously they can manage people's assets for them. But You know, it changes the whole conversation, but it becomes more objective. And I think that's a good thing, personally. It's hard when you're choosing to deviate from a standard benchmark or index. You have the chance of deviating the direction you don't want to deviate, which is underperforming it. You also have the chance you might outperform it. The only way you can outperform the benchmark is to be different than the benchmark. And if that's what you're going for, that's one approach. That's a different style of approach than what we're talking about. We're not talking about trying to beat the benchmark or what we're referencing. We're just trying to behave like the benchmark, understanding that through a process that we use and an interaction with clients, that it's appropriate that this benchmark is going to do the types of things they need to have done. So being like the benchmark achieves the goal. Just one style. Like you said, Jim, there's lots of different ways of doing this. If there was only one way to do this, somebody would have figured out how to program a computer to do it, and everyone would use that same thing, and everybody's portfolio would, you know, use these basic simple tools, and there you go. It'd be all in agreement. That's not how the investing world works. Probably never will.
No. So our belief is, if you're doing active management, you're going to want to make sure they are comparing what they're doing to a way for you to measure it. If they're just reviewing performance, last year we were up 14.8%. Relative to what? And that's the key. So I am a huge, huge proponent on active managing being benchmarked. But same with passive managing. Because if someone is saying, we're going to passively manage your portfolio, we're going to put you in our moderate model. I'm only using moderate because it's the most common model that we use. We're going to put you in a moderate model. And then you go in for your review or with us, you're over Zoom and we're doing a screen share and doing a review with you because we work with people all over the place. I have to be able to show, if all's what I was saying is, here's your moderate portfolio and last year it was up 9% and everything was great and we replaced this fund because of that reason, and you just do a review. But what if the benchmark was up only 6 and you were up 9, or up 13 and you were up 9? Wouldn't you want to know that and ask them why?
Right. The why is important. And maybe there's a perfectly good reason. Maybe there's a good reason, but you need to know that reason, because in a year where you're different in a good way, you're leaving yourself open in the future to be different in a bad way. Certainly, if you're different in a bad way now, there better be an explanation. Why? You know, I told you to do this. What you really delivered to me fell short of that. Why? And maybe they have a good explanation. They'll fix it. Moving forward, you're comfortable. Maybe no problem. But don't sit on your laurels if it's better than you expected, because that cracks open the door to be worse than expected in the future. And so it's just as important to get the explanation on the positive differential if you happen to face that, if they're willing to even benchmark, which most are not.
Most aren't. And what Chris was saying earlier, he got some of my story. I got stories for everything. I've been doing this for so long. He's confusing the stories when I would come back. I haven't been to seminars in over 2 years now because of COVID. But I would tell him every now and then, okay, I met another one, Chris. They told me when benchmarking comes up and I mentioned that I benchmark portfolios and they don't, I always ask why. Why? I'm like a 2-year-old. Why? 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 So I always will ask why. And we have had some pretty, very honest explanations from advisors. One specifically said, because he doesn't want to be evaluated by performance alone. And this was someone who was doing very little actual financial planning. The whole business model was AUM, assets under management, an asset gatherer, folks. And you were paying for management. You weren't getting much in financial planning. You were getting management. And he said, I don't benchmark because I don't want to be measured by performance alone. I remember when I told you that story, Chris, you were like, what the hell is he going to be measured on?
Right, right. The quality of the lobby in his office, the furniture, you know, that they get to sit in. How are you being judged here?
He very rarely did financial plans. He told me his plans started at $10,000. And I said, how many plans a year do you do? Mm-hmm. And he said, a few. I don't even know if that was the truth.
Right.
He said, a few. Mm-hmm. I told him what we were charging at the time, where he ripped me a new one like you did all the time as well. Mm-hmm. He couldn't believe what we were charging. But when I told him how many we did a year, he was amazed at that as well, but still thought, you're not charging enough. But the point back to him, folks, he very rarely did asset management. He was pushing AUM, asset.
No, very rarely
did financial planning. He was pushing a business model, which unfortunately in our industry is all too common. Let's just gather assets and manage them. Gather assets and manage them and charge 1% or 1.25%, 1.5%, or 0.8%, whatever they're going to charge you. And it's very scalable. So the more money they can gather, the more money they make. And it's a wonderful thing to say, I don't want to be evaluated on performance alone. But when that's really one of the main ways of evaluating you and you're denying it to a person, I don't like that. And another person, these are the only two that really stuck in my mind, said he didn't benchmark because he wanted to avoid difficult conversations.
Uncomfortable conversations.
That was essentially saying, I'm not matching a benchmark and I don't want to talk about it. That seriously was what it is. Uncomfortable. That's the word he used, not difficult. I want to avoid uncomfortable conversations. I'm not making this up, folks. These are what actual advisors are telling me when I go to events on why they don't benchmark. Few managers, investment advisory firms benchmark. It's just, they just don't.
Yeah. Or, what I've seen some that do, and actually there are some out there that do benchmark, and I think benchmark appropriately. So I do see that
we're not the only ones. We're not throwing them all under the bus.
No, but there's also the crew that do benchmarks, but they do it inappropriately. They inappropriately benchmark because they're not comparing apples to apples as far as risk. And that's misleading, just point blank. I'm surprised that I see that occasionally when I do.
Sadly,
but it is out there.
It is, because sadly, I have reviewed client statements, and some will have various benchmarks. I've seen some. There was one in particular that I looked at not too long ago, Chris. The portfolio was a moderately aggressive portfolio, and they had three benchmarks for this person to compare the moderately aggressive portfolio to. The first, three-month T-bills, which... was perfect, right? I mean, that's apple to apple, correct?
Oh, yeah.
A three-month T-bill and a moderately aggressive portfolio.
Sorry, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
I'm not making this up.
Kind of to the extreme, but that's what I'm talking about.
If I named the firm that's doing it, it's a national firm.
I know.
I'm not going to name them because they're not here to defend themselves, but if I named them, everyone here would have heard of them. Three-month T-bill, intermediate bonds, an S&P 500. Those were, and I showed it to Travis, and he joked. He says, well, maybe the person's then supposed to take those three indexes, make a composite benchmark out of them, and compare their portfolio to it.
Yeah, because none of those
are appropriate
expected to compare to a moderately aggressive approach. It's a big basket of fruit. Not a single apple-to-apple comparison in there at all.
The other thing, if you do benchmark or if someone does benchmark a firm benchmarks, sometimes they're composite benchmarks. And they'll mark it, and at the bottom of the statement, they'll tell you what indexes are in the composite. But just remember, they are making the composite. I always look at those with, at least they're trying. Mm-hmm. But I say to myself all the time, why don't you just use an independent? Why are you? It's kind of like you're holding the rope and saying, okay, measure me against this.
Yeah. Well, it's we're running a race against yourself. It's not objective. That's the issue.
But the point is, folks, I have seen them. Mm-hmm. I've never been present for any review meetings. So it's quite possible these investment advisors are reviewing this, but they're not on the documents, the paperwork that I'm seeing. I'm not in the meetings, though. They're just showing performance numbers, Chris, when you benchmark, or you're asking your advisor to benchmark for you, it's not just looking at performance numbers. Make sure they show you correlation. They'll call it R squared, but correlation, how correlated is your portfolio to the benchmark? Standard deviation. How is your portfolio's historical standard deviation, which is volatility, how much you can go higher or lower than the expected mean? That's standard deviation. Just Google it if you don't understand some of the words we're using. So you want to look at that. And beta. Beta is an easy number to look at for risk. You want to make sure those numbers are fairly close, Chris. They're not going to be spot on. It's impossible to be spot on. But you don't want to have a portfolio. Maybe the return is nearly identical, but your portfolio is carrying 20% more volatility and 10% more risk and just 80% of the correlation to the benchmark. Is that truly an appropriate benchmark? Or is your advisor, maybe the benchmark is perfect, Chris. Mm-hmm. So now it can.
But they're drifting away.
Right. So you can ask the advisor.
Why?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I see you're not following. Is there a reason why? Mm-hmm. Well, yes. If you remember in my approach, even though I'm going to try to benchmark you, we are active. We're not passive. Mm-hmm. And we feel for this reason and that reason, we want to be overweighted in this. Perfect. Mm-hmm.
If you agree with it and you buy into it, then they're doing what you want.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you pay for that. That costs a little more money, and they very well may be worth it. Absolutely. We're not throwing active managers under the bus. I have nothing against it. Please understand that if you're an advisor listening to this. I'm just trying to tell the non-advisor listeners here that if you are working with someone like that, if you want to really measure your money's worth, you should be asking these types of questions. Anyways, I don't want to beat that horse to death anymore on benchmarking. It's just I'm trying to give you over these past two shows why I got to the point I'm at now on how we offer our asset management service. But there's one, here's the, what do we call it? The teaser.
The teaser for next time?
The teaser for next time. Out of everything that Chris and I have gone through, there's one other element I wanted to address. And I mentioned it in the first show, but we didn't talk about it much. Remember I said, Chris, I wanted to see what went wrong. Was it my choices of funds or was it active management itself? And I really had to do some deep soul searching on what is the best way to manage money for decumulation, for people who are aging, for people whose minds are not getting sharper but duller. And that's going to be me too, folks. It will be. I'm 58. 20 years from now, I'm 78. And I may most likely not even be doing this by then because of that reason. So those were the two things I was looking at. But there's another element, folks, that I needed to address as I reevaluated how we do things. And it's my biggest, well, I don't want to say biggest, there's tons of complaints I have about our industry. But it's what I feel is so wrong with our industry. Fees. And they're so opaque. Is that the correct word I used?
Yep.
Thank you. They're so opaque. If you're paying someone 1% to manage your assets, just let's use one because that's the industry standard. And ask someone, why do they charge you 1%? You'll probably make them, they'll be shocked someone asked because they don't know. It's just what everybody does. So let's just pretend a 1% fee and you've got a $3 million portfolio. And again, whether you have more or less, I'm just choosing a number. So you're paying someone $30,000 a year. Mm-hmm. If you were paying someone 30 grand a year, Chris, what's, just give me like the first question that pops into your head. If I know that like 10 questions popped in. See if you can guess where I'm going with this.
Well, what are you doing for me?
Exactly.
If I was going to hire someone and pay them $30,000 a year, I want to know what they're going to do for me and make sure that they're providing to me enough value. And that's kind of what you're doing when you hire an advisor. They're not an employee of yours, but you're essentially hiring them for a job. What are you going to do for me? What are you doing for me? And oh, here, when I look at it, it turns out I'm paying you $30,000 a year. What are you doing for me?
What am I getting for it?
And a professional, in my personal opinion, should be able to answer that directly.
Not only that, and I firmly believe this, folks, they should show you and break it down. Chris and I, well, Chris came on board with me, but you never questioned me. You questioned my prices, but you never questioned my philosophy on it. From day one, Chris, you always knew financial planning and investment management were always separate. Mm-hmm. You did not come on board and have me manage your assets and you got a quote-unquote free financial plan with it. You wanted financial planning, you paid for it. You wanted investment management, you paid for it. And on the financial planning, you pay us for a retirement plan, you pay us for a tax plan, you would pay us for tax preparation, you would pay for an aging analysis, you might pay us for an insurance review. We freely disclose or fully disclose the cost, what you're going to get for it. It's not just this opaque number that, okay, we're going to charge you $10,000 and you don't know where it's going, or $30,000. So that's how we do our retirement plan. And our retirement planning is not 10 or 30. Those were bad numbers I should have used. But if you hire us for retirement planning, you get a pretty much flat quoted fee and you know what you're paying. And it's all unbundled, if you will. It's a see-through fee, to borrow from a see-through trust.
Which is abnormal in our industry.
It is. So it's totally abnormal.
That's the teaser is, I'm sure that's the next direction we're going, is
that's what we do on the investment management side.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes us truly unique. The fact that we're passive managers doesn't make us unique anymore. Not that it ever did. By the time I got into it, it was no longer unique. It's not, in my opinion, anything that no one else can't do. It's so we're passive. Half the industry's passive, half is active.
And this is an approach, actually, that's very easily replicated by do-it-yourselfers.
Yeah. Most of you are passive approaches, you Vanguardians. What I wanted, after I knew what I was going to do, simultaneously, I was attacking fees. And I was attacking and telling my clients this. We were with a different custodian back then. I had a different business model. And I was telling all my clients, all of them knew, we were analyzing active and passive. The core portfolios, I had told people, they're probably not going to be here long. We're evaluating. We may be going to a passive approach. When I adopted it, I let existing clients choose, do you want to stay in what we have? Or do you want to move to our passive? Now we're 100% passive. Anyone new coming on, they have to be passive. And I think off the top of my head, all of our older clients are fully passive now as well. But I'd have to research to see if that part is true. But I also shared with them, Chris, there were three fees that I was attacking. And that's what we're going to get into next week, how we made our fee structure. In my opinion, I like this just popped into my head, see-through. They are see-through. You can look right in and see. We attacked the fee you're going to pay me, the fee that we have to do at the custodial level, and the fee that we're doing on the invest or have to pay on the investment management level. Those are the three fees. You got to add all those together to find out what you're totally paying. I wanted to remove that, Chris, from that deep, dark cellar of just, I'm charging you 0.5% or 1% or 1.25%. So that's what we did. We structured our fees to be as, in our opinion, transparent as our financial planning fees. And I do think that that is an approach that stands apart from others. And it's not truly what I think is ultimately what I like about our asset management approach. I love our fee structure, and we're going to get into that next week. And then we're going to wrap the show up with a more detailed explanation of positioning, which I think is truly the most unique aspect to the way we manage assets. It's not just that we're passive and we benchmark and we fully disclose our fees and we have a capped structure. So if you bring more money over to us, you don't pay more. It's not all those unique things, Chris. You know, because I keep talking about this in the office. I think it's positioning and how we do it and build it into our portfolios that I think is what truly makes us unique. So now you know the why. Next week, we're going to get into the how a little bit, But then our fee structure and the final show is going to be a deeper dive into positioning. And then you'll have, in a nutshell, how we manage assets and why are we sharing this with you. It's not a big running commercial, and hopefully it doesn't sound like one. I'm trying to teach you, and we are going to disclose it. Those of you who are not do-it-yourselfers, I want you to take a lot of what we're sharing, what our beliefs are, meld them in with your beliefs, and then talk to your existing advisors about some of these things. If you're not being benchmarked, or if you're paying a flat AUM fee and they're not itemizing it at the end of the year and saying, okay, we charged you $30,000, you know, $11,000 went to this, $2,000 went to administrative expenses, this went to the planning fee or whatever. If they're not itemizing it, how do you know what the hell you're paying for? And if they're not giving you a benchmark to compare the investment management, how do you know you're getting anything for those dollars? And then what dollars are going, if any, towards the quote-unquote financial planning? And do you think they delivered enough financial planning to justify that portion of their AUM fee? That's what I don't like about our industry. They charge a fee. And why the regulators don't make you break it out, Chris?
Well, I know why. They're technically disclosing it, right? But there's a difference between disclosing the fee and having the fee understandable, justifiable, and transparent. That part isn't required by the regulators.
But disclosure, that amazes me.
Right. Disclosure is required. So yeah, any place you go has to tell you, we're going to charge you 1%, 2%, 1.3, 0.8, whatever the number is. But beyond that, they don't have to do anything because they've told you what it is, and you either like it and you hire them or you don't, and you go into the free market and you find somebody else that does it differently. That the rest of that story of what the breakdown and the transparency. Now, sometimes it is kind of hard if people are doing all kinds of wild things for you, how to piece part it together. So I admit that there are some models and there's some people that do such different types of planning than we do. It might be very hard to put a dollar amount on each different activity. It can certainly be hard, but I think you need to try at least and not just wave your arms at it and say, we can't do it. It's 1%, you know, take it or leave it.
But a businessman or woman, if they're charging a fee, they should have been researching and figuring out, okay, what do I need? What's my profitability? What's my cost per client? What am I running? What do I have to do? And I'm hoping they base their AUM off of that analysis. But I'm afraid they don't. And it's just, well, the industry charges one, so I'm charging one.
Mm-hmm. That's mostly it.
And that's mostly it. And that's why I think it's a travesty. And then I'll let Chris go off on the regulators because we have to jump through so many hoops, Chris, because we are so transparent.
Yeah.
If we were just charging an AUM fee, oh my God, it would be so much easier on the compliance side. Mm-hmm. We actually have to show we are delivering value for each of the line items we pull out on our financial planning side. Yeah.
Well, we can talk about that next time. Get into fees and stuff because we're long. We're getting a little carried away. So we'll wrap it here. This was a very special show, though, because a classic gymism came back.
What?
Yeah. You haven't said pulling teeth from a baby in at least months, if not years. That is a classic gymism. Those of you who have been with us for a long time, as soon as you heard that, I'm sure your ears perked up. The beating the horse to death, that comes up all the time, but the man, that pulling teeth from a baby sure brought back memories. So I just wanted to point that out at the end.
I don't even remember where I said
it was
that.
A while back. I just made a note. So, so next time we'll be headed on this journey of multiple shows about our asset management, how our philosophy and how we do it. Again, we're not, you know, it's not meant as a long-running advertisement. It's meant as an educational exercise, things to think about when you're deciding, A, who to hire if you're going to have somebody do it, whether it's us or, you know, somebody else. Tons of people are out there listening to the show, and then they hire somebody else. Totally understandable. Get it. Lots of reasons you hire somebody to give you help. There's tons of do-it-yourselfers, too, though, and I think this is important to consider for do-it-yourselfers because they're kind of in the shoes that the gym was in, kind of deciding which direction should we go. Should we be looking at these more active investment choices versus more passive investment choices and what makes more sense for me? So it's kind of this blended thing, explaining more of what we do so you get to know about us specifically, but also just food for thought for you out there in do-it-yourself land. So we'll pick up where we left off in the next show. Thanks a lot again, Jim.
Okay.
Everybody, thanks again for listening, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show in the series, you know, the third show in the series of right now unknown length.
No, it'll be four.
But I think four sounds about right. Yeah, so we'll be back next week. We'll continue the story.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.